I will officially open up the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee meeting for Thursday, February 7th. Y'all set? Okay. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Senator Jackie Dingfelder, and welcome to the first meeting of the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee for the 2013 session. First of all, I just want to thank everybody for accommodating change of schedule. We don't normally meet in this room or on this day, so please make a note that in the future we're going to be meeting Mondays and Wednesdays from 3 to 5 in Hearing Room C. So now you have a sense of what it's like to be on the Judiciary Committee, because I'm up here every day in the morning anyway. With that, what I'd like to do is start with committee introductions, both committee members and staff. And I think I'll start with one of our new members, Senator Bates, and we'll just work our way across the dais. Welcome, Senator Bates. Senator Bates and I have served together for over a decade, and we figured out this is the first time in 12 years that we've served on a committee together. So I'm really pleased that he's here to join us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm pleased with you, too. I've avoided this for 10 years. Sometimes it happens. I'm Senator Alan Bates. I'm a physician in Southern Oregon, and my district is Medford-Ashland, as many of you already know. This is a pleasure, actually, for me to be back in the Environmental Committee. I served there for two different sessions, and I chaired Natural Resources one time, too. So it's really great to be back. To be blunt, I am a pretty big environmentalist. It's the second half of my life that I enjoy the most. I spend every hour I have fly fishing on various rivers around Oregon, and camping and hiking. So I'm kind of there.
Well, we're really pleased to have you here, and welcome to the committee.
Yeah. If things go well, I'll have fresh trout for you in May. Okay.
Sounds like a deal.
I'm Beth Riley, the committee administrator that's going to be working with you this session.
Thank you. I'm Senator Jackie Dingfelder, and I am really pleased and honored to be back as chair of this committee. I sat down and figured out that this is the seventh year that I've chaired the Environment Committee. I chaired 2 years in the House, and then I've chaired for 4 years in the Senate, and obviously starting into my seventh year. So it's an honor and a pleasure to be back here. I'm really pleased to have Beth, used to be Beth Herzog, she's now Beth Riley, as committee staff. Beth, we worked together in 2009. Mm-hmm. She did a fabulous job, and you know, I just know that anybody named Beth is going to do a great job for our committee, because we had Beth Petrino last time, who we know went over to the House, and we will be thinking of her fondly, but we know that Beth and the Beths are almost joined at the hip, so the good news is that we know we'll be coordinating very closely with the House. A little bit of my background: I actually am a geomorphologist by training, and I have a master's in water resources management in environmental planning, and I'm working on a PhD because I'm a glutton for punishment at Portland State University. I also have worked for many years in public, private, nonprofit sector and on environmental and natural resource issues. And I recently took a new position as executive director for a nonprofit that works on river restoration here in the Northwest. So really pleased about that. Half-time position because many of you know we are part-time legislators, but many of us have other day jobs. As you know, we have other things that at least keep us paying the rent, let's put it that way, because we do part of our work here is out of our love for public service. So really pleased to be back here, and I'm also thrilled to have some new committee members who I think will shake up our committee a little bit. They bring a different perspective, and looking forward to a productive session. And of course, I want to welcome back the old committee members. Welcome back, Senator Hess.
When you say old. Mark Hass from the Beaverton area. I'm pleased to be here. I think this is my third regular session on this committee, and pleased to be serving with such a distinguished panel.
Thank you.
My name is Bill Hansel. I am the rookie of the committee. I'm in my fourth day as a state senator, as far as the session is concerned. I grew up on a wheat and cattle ranch north of the little community of Athena in Umatilla County. I was privileged to serve for 30 years as a Umatilla County commissioner, was involved in a variety of things during that period of time. It's an honor when Dave Nelson, a good friend, decided that he was going to retire, suggested and encouraged me to run for the state Senate. And so I was successful in that, and then officially retired or resigned from that on the 31st of January. So it's the District 29 includes six entire counties and a portion of rural Wasco. I have Umatilla, Union, Wallowa, Morro, Gillam, Sherman, and rural Wasco. And we are a natural resource-based economy throughout my district. It's the third largest district geographically in Oregon. So as my colleague Senator Bates said, he was very blunt that he is very much on the environmental side. I'll be equally blunt that I'm on the natural resources management development side. So that's what fuels our economy. I'm a farm boy from Eastern Oregon, and it's a pleasure to be on this committee.
Thank you. Welcome. And our committee staff?
Yes, I'm Jennifer Luttman, the committee assistant.
And Jennifer, what do you do in your, when you're not here?
I work seasonally for the National Park Service at Glacier National Park.
I want that job.
Right, that's what we all said. So, well, great. And Jennifer's new committee staff, we're looking forward to working with her. I probably should have mentioned my district. The district I represent is Northeast Southeast Portland. However, due to my work background, I've probably visited every watershed in the state, walked a lot of the streams, canoed and kayaked a lot of the rivers, and it is truly an incredible state, and we're really fortunate to have a lot of geographic diversity as well on this committee. And the Vice Chair, Senator Olson, he couldn't be here. He may be here a little bit later, and he represents the area in Clackamas County. So with that, we're going to go ahead with committee rules adoption. At the beginning of each committee session, we adopt rules. Hopefully, everybody should have received that from their committee staff. With that, I will take a motion on the committee rules.
I move to adopt the proposed committee rules.
Okay, Senator Haas moves to adopt the proposed committee rules. Is there any discussion on the rules? Okay, any objections? Seeing none, the motion passes. The rules are adopted. So with that, we have a few committee measures that we would like to introduce. And just for the record, the adoption of committee measures is just that. It's only for the consideration of these measures. It does not mean that voting yes for adoption is a support of the measures. It's just for further discussion once these measures are adopted. They may or may not be assigned to our committee, too. I should make that clear. So with that, I will take a motion on the committee measures. Actually, do you want to just, Beth, mention what they are?
Yes, you have LC-3116 in front of you, which requires the State Department of Energy to convene a work group to investigate and develop recommended strategies to impose carbon tax. You have LC-1047, which permits a state agency to implement a program to distribute, dispense, or otherwise make electricity available for use in motor vehicles.
Okay, with that, I will take a motion on committee measure, introduction of committee measures.
Okay. Do we need to be in a work session?
Yes. Thanks. I'll open up a work session for adoption of committee members.
Madam Chair, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC-1047, dated 1/22/13; LC-3116, dated 2/7/13.
Okay, we're just going to wait for Senator Bates because I didn't realize he just stepped out. So we'll be at ease for a minute. Rules. And so Representative Haas moves the following LCs be introduced: LC-1047, dated 1/22/13, and LC-3116, dated 2/7/13. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, the measures are introduced as committee bills. So with that, I will close the work session. And I guess we already have an informational hearing open, or do I need to reopen that? Okay. So we are in an informational hearing right now. We will not be hearing any committee, any bills today. We'll start that next Monday. And I just want to make sure you should be receiving your agendas. If for any reason If you have any questions about receiving anything from this committee, Beth is the person to go to, and certainly we try to post everything as soon as we can. So with that, I have asked several folks to come and provide some informational sessions for us. We deal with, there's 14 different natural resources agencies. Almost all of them will come through our committee at one time or another. And we deal with a lot of, with a diverse number of issues. Of course, water is a big one, and we're going to hear probably two-thirds of our informational session today will be on aspects of water. But one of the very important elements that this committee deals with is our state parks. We did not have a lot of time last session to hear from state parks and to be provided with updates on their programs. And so we're going to hear today from the director and the assistant director of our Parks and Recreation Department on the work that they're doing and also their systems plan. And I think this will queue up for several bills that we have in our committee as well dealing with parks. So with that, I'd like to invite up Tim Wood and John Potter. And just a reminder, I think everybody probably knows, turn off your cell phones, and I always like to remind folks if you want to have a conversation in the committee, it's fine to do it out in the hall, but I will ask for your respect during our committees to keep those conversations at a minimum. We will, one of the downsides of this room, unfortunately, is the challenging AV system. So the folks in the audience cannot see the slides. And I don't know if, Tim, did you provide paper handouts of the slides?
Yeah, no, I did not. Not for the audience.
So they are posted, and for folks that are listening in on the committee, those will be posted on OLIS. So certainly I apologize that you won't be able to see them. The other thing is we can probably see them. We could have turned them around for the audience to see it because we have our computers here, some of us do. But just so you know that if in the future we will have better AV in the rooms. So, Senator Bates, we're starting off with the State Parks presentation.
Thank you. And sorry, I had to step out.
No, it's okay. We knew where to find you. As long as you didn't steal my scooter, that's the main thing.
I think it's pretty safe.
Great.
Welcome, Director.
All right. Thanks, Senator Dingfelder, members of the committee. I'm Tim Wood, the Director of the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, and with me this afternoon is John Potter. John's the Assistant Director. John runs the park system portion of our department. So what we would like to do this afternoon is a couple things. One is I was going to give you a very, very high-level overview of kind of what we do in the park in the Parks and Recreation Department. We are more than the park system, and so I just wanted to remind folks of some of the other responsibilities that we have. Talk briefly about the State Scenic Waterway Program, which is a program that we administer in our department, but most importantly, spend some time with you talking about what we call our State Park System Plan. And this is a plan that was adopted by our commission a couple of months ago, last November, I guess, after about a year and a half worth of work at looking at where we might be 10 years from now, to try to set the stage about making decisions now so that we are where we need to be 10 years from now instead of sort of facing a crisis without, you know, just kind of stumbling through it. So,
and
John,
Doctor, before you get going, can you just remind us about your commission? How many members serve? Are they at large or geographical? And so you have that up there.
I'll do that. Good point. So thank you, Senator Dingfelder. The department is overseen by a commission, which is appointed by the governor. We have seven members, one from each congressional district, one from east of the Cascades, and one from west of the Coast Range. So we have seven members, and our commission is currently at full capacity. We'll be losing one commission member in March when he finishes two full terms, which is Jim Brown, the former state forester, is a member of our commission.
And just remind me, do you have the authority to adopt rules, or is that the commission's authority?
Senator Dingfelder, that rulemaking is reserved for the commission. Basically, the statute gives me the authority to make all the decisions in the department except for two things. One is real property transactions, and the other is rulemaking. So, great.
Sorry, jump the gun.
No, that's fine. Back up one. Yeah, so the major programs that the Park and Recreation Department is responsible for are shown here. Our mission is to protect and provide special places for present and future generations as relates to natural, cultural, scenic, and recreational assets of the state. So our work kind of breaks out into four areas. We operate the state park system, which is probably what we are most known for. We have about 40 million visitor days in our park system a year in the Oregon State Park System. That ranks fourth nationally. And we rank second nationally in terms of number of visitors per acre in our system. Another important aspect is we provide grants to communities for parks, recreation, and heritage purposes. In our budget in 13-15 is a request for about $38 million in funds, which will be passed through to other jurisdictions for park and recreation purposes. That includes heritage grants. We run the state's all-terrain vehicle program, the local government grant program, which is funded by ballot measure 66, now 76 money, county opportunity grants for county park systems. We pass about a $1.2 million back to local entities through lodging taxes each year. And then we also manage the federal Recreation Trails Program and the federal Land and Water Conservation Fund Program. We also operate the Oregon State Fair and Expo Center. The fair is about an 11-day event that occurs and ends on Labor Day each September. And then we're also responsible for the operation of the Expo Center, which is the other 50 weeks of the year. And then last but not least is our heritage services programs. You hear folks talk about the National Register. Well, we run the National Register of Historic Properties program for the National Park Service in our department. We have several commissions. We have the Historic Cemeteries Commission, the Heritage Commission. We're also responsible for overseeing archaeological protection or protection of the state's archaeological resources as well. Okay. Quickly, I already talked about the commission and its responsibilities. So within the director's office, about four primary responsibilities or functions which occur there. We have an internal auditor, quality assurance person. HR works directly for myself, communications and project management for special projects. But the bulk of the work is done down there on the bottom line. That's our operation of our state park system. Various programs are managed through the state park system, and that's under John's supervision. Scenic waterways, we're responsible for management of the ocean shore from Washington to California. So all 362 miles of that is managed, and so you're probably familiar with our role in things like Japanese tsunami debris cleanup, which we did a little of this week, I guess, if you've seen the news. Willamette Greenway, Deschutes Management, that section is also responsible for park planning, our maintenance and repair program, and for all our natural resource management programs. Community and heritage programs, principally grant programs, and then assistance to communities. And administration, besides the State Fair and Expo Center, that's sort of where all of our accounting, budget, IT, operation of our reservation system all lies within the administration section. So that's probably more than 35,000 foot. That's probably a 50,000 foot overview of sort of the functions of the department. What I'd like to do now is turn over to John. John, talk briefly about the State Scenic Waterways Program and then spend more time on our state park system plan.
So the first thing I was going to talk about was the Scenic Waterways Program, which is a relatively minor component of what we do. This program was first put together in around 1970, I believe in 1970, and the purpose of it is to protect the scenic values of several of 19 rivers, actually, and Waldo Lake, so 20 water bodies throughout the state. And notification is required of landowners adjacent to these areas for any activities that occur within a quarter mile of the bank, for the activities such as cutting of trees, building roads, or construction of buildings, utilities, utility lines, and so forth. Activities require approval or else they are suspended for 1 year, and once 1 year passes, if the landowner desires to proceed, they may proceed with what they have notified us of. Currently, the program is takes approximately 520 hours of staff time. That's distributed over four natural resource specialists located throughout the state. They're responding to people's applications and going out and looking at the sites and coming up with the conditions by which the application might be approved. It costs us a little over $13,000 a year and is a relatively minor component of the responsibilities of these staff. Any questions?
I do. I have on this area of your department. And Tim, I'm going to direct this question to you if I could. Does your department have a responsibility for bringing forward proposals to expand the state scenic waterways?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Bates, yes. So if somebody... If a proposal were to come forward to the department, other than, I know you have a legislative bill, so other than a bill, perhaps, that would come to us and would be processed by both Parks in conjunction with the Water Resources Department.
Hello, Madam Chair. Not today or not now, but I'd like to have you review ORS 390.855 and see what the meaning is to you. Meaning to us at this point is that you have a responsibility to bring these forward yourself in concurrence with the water department, and then bring it to the governor. So we'd like to hear a little more about that later on. It's a statute that's old, hasn't been looked at for a long time. No new waterways have been designated in a long time. So we've got some special issues out there right now that this may be an avenue we may want to go down to look at. So I appreciate you reviewing those and getting back to us and see what you think that statute says. We have an understanding already from LC what it says. Well, I like what you think it says, too.
Great.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Great. Thank you for the questions. Okay. Proceed.
Okay. So now I'd like to speak with you a little bit about the state park system, which was first recognized as a system in the state around 1929 with the appointment of Sam Boardman as the first parks superintendent. Since that time, approximately 350 properties statewide have been added to the system and are now managed by the department. It consists of slightly over 108,000 acres of land and includes 56 overnight parks as well as 150 day use parks, waysides, and natural areas throughout the state. We receive approximately 42 million visitors on average a year. That's been relatively steady over the past several years. 2 million of that are overnight stays, and the other 40 million are day use. And some of the more well-known parks are listed here, and I'm sure there's one near a place that you love and care for. The park system workforce consists primarily of rangers, natural resource specialists, and park managers, and we spend about 770,000 hours annually on providing these 42 million opportunities for park visits. We also rely considerably on volunteer hours. There are about 529,000 hours of volunteer time that go into supporting the provision of park opportunities to visitors. And we also do hire out some work to inmate crews as well as contracted services, and there are 8 to 10 concessions throughout the park system at any one time. As we were looking at strategic planning for the state park system, we started with thinking about how do the parks create value in the state? And there are a number of ways that we came up with that they do. The first being probably the intrinsic value of every visitor as they go to a park. What is that worth to them? We looked at some studies and did some surveys of visitors, and we ended up concluding that the average value of a visit to one of the state parks is about $100. If you look at the average amount of time that people spend and their willingness to do that activity as opposed to others. Other values that the park system generates are in ecosystem services, reduction of health costs due to the outdoor activities that people are engaged in, educational opportunities in the parks is a significant contribution that these properties make. They contribute property value enhancement to neighboring properties, and they also are important for their amenity and existence value. In terms of economic activity, the parks have some significance in just the $30 million or so that are spent by the department every year in the local communities and throughout the state. But probably the one of the really the most significant economic activities is generated is by the visitors themselves. And we have done some studies with OSU, and Professor Eric White at OSU has looked at the visitor, he's surveyed the visitors that come to the state parks and has found that on average the amount of spending that visitors are doing when they visit the parks is about $17 on average per visit. And this consists of things like gas, food, groceries, restaurants, other recreational activities. And this $17 that's generated per visit, of that about 47 cents is captured in the form of day use fees that the state park system charges, or overnight fees. Some of the challenges that the state park system faces is an aging infrastructure. There are approximately 1,900 public and non-public buildings throughout the system, 600 major utility systems, and 72 million square feet of transportation network, including parking areas, roads, and trails. The average age of the buildings is about 35 years, which is on the higher end of what you might expect the expected service life of non-residential buildings to be. And so this is a growing area of need in terms of keeping the infrastructure operating and functionally fully to the expectations of the park visitors. Over time, our deferred maintenance over the past 10 years has been reduced considerably due to the passage of the Measure 66 and the Measure 76 funding. However, while we've had a focus on dropping the backlog of deferred maintenance since 1999, as well as addressing emergency repairs and replacements that come up every year, we have had emerging projects that just come as a result of the ownership of property and the ongoing needs of facilities to be maintained. And so we currently are holding about a $77 million deferred maintenance list, which is an asset condition index around 17%, which is considered considered a managed care situation in the industry standard, and one that we would still like to see reduce further. Part of the reasons that it's not to more of a stewardship level in terms of deferred maintenance are some of the unanticipated budget changes that have occurred within the department over the last 10 years since the passage of Measure 66. And I'm sure you're aware of some of these, such as the removal of the general fund from the department's budget, the state fair debt and operating costs, which have been added as a responsibility of the department. Changes to the funding split for RV registrations, changes to how local government grants are allocated, fee waivers, as well as transfers to other natural resource agencies and the care of the state capital, state park.
A quick clarification. At this point, the amount of general fund you receive is?
The amount of Senator Dingfelder, the amount of general fund we receive is zero at this point. The amount that we received in 1999 was $12 million, and if it was grown at the rate of the rest of the government, it would be approximately this amount in, would have been approximately this amount in the
And then what percentage, just a follow-up, of lottery versus fees is your budget at this point? I should know this from Ways and Means, but not off the top of my head.
Senator Dingfelder, it's approximately two-thirds to a third. And I just would add additionally that the $56 million in lottery that's available to the state park system in this last in this current biennium is down from about $70 million at the peak in 2007-09. So we've had about a 20% drop over the past several bienniums. So as we were grappling with those challenges and trying to come up with what do we do to mitigate that and how do we address it moving forward, we developed an economic model. The financial services section in our department developed an economic model that looked at projecting revenues and projecting expenditures out for the next 10 years. And the key drivers for revenues for us are, of course, the lottery, but also overnight and day use rates, as well as occupancy. The third major revenue driver for us are license revenues, and finally, grants and donations. So we looked at those on the revenue side, and on the expenditure side, the key drivers are workforce, inflation, and energy costs. And so we also looked at those and developed a model that that had three scenarios: an optimistic one, what if things go really well; a moderate one, which essentially lines with the current DAS projections of where these various drivers are going; and then thirdly, a pessimistic one, what if life is not as good as planned. And so, for example, with the lottery driver, for the optimistic model, we assumed 8.5% growth. For the moderate, we assumed 6.3% growth, as is currently projected. And with a pessimistic, we assumed a 2.5% growth in lottery. Likewise, on the expenditure side, workforce being the primary driver, we looked at a 9% cost of workforce increase as the optimistic, a 12% for the moderate, and a 14% for the pessimistic. So when you run this through and you project it out over 10 years, it results in a picture of what the funding gaps or surplus might be in the out biennium, so 21-23, in this particular example on this slide shown here. And what we learned was that the park system will disappoint Oregonians over the next 10 years if moderate or pessimistic conditions prevail. That is, unless adjustments are made. So the net revenue curves that are shown on this slide show, you can see the zero line, and most of the projections are below those, certainly in the moderate or pessimistic. And the moderate to moderate scenario puts us at about a $15.4 million hole at 21-23. Another way to look at this is on a graph that shows the projected expenditures by year and the projected revenues by year. And the gap between these two lines is essentially a $46 million gap, which would either need to be made up with reductions in expenditures or increases in revenues. This gap in the 21-23 biennium is equivalent to the projected cost to operate the following parks: Detroit, Milo McIver, Smith Rock, Collier, Cape Blanco, Carl Washburn, and Halem Bay. So that's a pretty significant chunk of this park system if it were to be taken all out of expenditures. Likewise, if that had to be taken as a straight reduction in park operations, it would equate to about a $772 million impact in terms of that visitor economic activity that I showed you before. More likely, we would address this gap as time went on, and things like land acquisitions would go on to life support. We would continue to build up our asset condition index back towards the 33% that we had in 1999, as opposed to the 17% currently. We would not be addressing any demand for any new park opportunities, and we'd be reducing service levels in underperforming parks. So what do we need to do? plan that we came up with really at a high level had four components, the first being that we need to focus on the things that set the state park system apart. And so that's the iconic, the classic properties and resources that are associated with the key state parks. Also, it's the customer service and the level of care that our staff take at those properties. The second thing that we need to do is to continue to generate more and more economic impact within the parks, drawing people in and attracting them to the local communities where the state parks are located. So that's looking at ways to increase that $17 per visit and trying to make it more of an impact to everyone closely associated with the parks in those communities. Finally, it's raising revenues within that context, and it's cutting costs while maintaining that value creation.
John, I have a quick question.
Yes.
On that other slide about raising revenues. With our fee, how do our fees compare with California and Washington? I know I've seen in the past where we are, but can you maybe talk a little bit about that?
Yes, Senator Dingfelder. Our fees are competitive with surrounding states, probably a little bit low compared to them. It's difficult to do a straight comparison because of the range of different things that people are paying for. One of the things that we are proposing in the current budget is to do a slight increase to our rates. And in fact, that's one of the resulting strategies here, is to do incremental rate increases to keep up with the market. And it's not just, while our primary competition is probably with the surrounding states, it's also a concern for local and county parks as well. So the key things where this plan calls for support, where it's needed, is protection from the loss of public support revenues moving forward. You can see that there's considerable financial challenges being faced by the park system. Any additional impact to the revenue stream that we're already projecting, of course, brings that line down even further and increases the gap and the impact to local economic activity. So the second thing is regular incremental rate increases, which we will continue to look at and propose as they fit within the market context. Third is seeking authority for a greater flexibility on pricing, as well as working with nonprofits to help the private sector support the state park system in funding maintenance and enhancements that it can't support through the diminishing public funding. And finally, the park system really needs support and understanding when service reductions may be necessary at lower performing parks. So I've addressed four things for you: the values that the state park system creates, some of the challenges that we're facing, how that looks and what the projection looks like moving out over the next 10 years, and the plan that we would like to implement to try to mitigate that and make sure that we can continue to offer excellent park opportunities to Oregonians and visitors from California and Washington and Idaho. And so we're looking for the room and the tools to get our house in order and provide a sustainable park system for you. So.
Thank you, gentlemen. So any questions for even Ms. Shanley, Senator House?
Thank you. The presentation is very financially developed, and I just think there's way too much focus on economic activity, economic development from our Parks Department. And while that's not a bad thing, to me, the focus should be on getting Oregon families to these parks, especially their kids, for affordable vacations. And I'm more concerned about how you're putting value into that more than I am about the indirect effects to some of these coastal towns and all of that. I mean, I was hoping you would say, this is a new section of the vista where we can see the ocean, and here's some new trails we did in the Halen Bay, and we added this, and we got horse riding and Stewart Park and all of those things. That, to me, I think is the focus. The Oregon State Parks is not an economic development tool of the state. I mean, we've got other systems for that. We're working on that already. And I understand you have to recover costs, but yeah. That's just my honest candid take on what you just gave us. And I don't think you should be increasing rates to help make up some of these costs. And maybe it's private donations, and maybe it's other places. You're in the lottery now. It's not like the question that we had in 1999 when you weren't and there was general fund. Things have changed. But these are jewels in Oregon. These are not economic development strategies. And so I'm hoping that in the next presentation we hear more about that, and that we can make sure that that's our focus as opposed to economic development. And I want us to keep these rates frozen or at least affordable for Oregon families to enjoy these things, because for a lot of Oregon families, this is where they vacation. And I would hate to price those families out of this vacation, because it's not like they're going to go to Disneyland if they can't afford to go to Cape Lookout. So I guess that's my plea for you, and my questions would be, what are you working on to keep these rates frozen and locked down and affordable?
Sure. Senator Dingfelder, Senator Haas, I appreciate your comment, because that's really a struggle, is figuring out how we keep the system accessible and affordable to a large portion of the population and still, you know, figure out how to maintain it financially. The rate increases that we are talking about in our budget in this coming biennium in 13-15 are really related to the higher amenity rates, so that basically the higher-end RVs, which use larger amounts of services, water, electricity, sewage treatment, that's where our focus is for our rate increases. We don't propose an increase in our day-use fee. We have about, I think it's 26 parks out of all the ones we have in our system where we charge a day-use parking fee. So most all of our parks are accessible for day use without charge, and frankly, you know, keeping rates low enough that we don't preclude folks from enjoying the parks is a very important consideration, and I do appreciate your concern. I'd love to have another hour and a half to tell you all the great things we're doing, you know, across the park system. One of the features in our budget this year is a continuation of a project that we've been working on for about 4 years, and that's Cottonwood Canyon State Park, which is located out on John Day River. One side of it's in Gillum County, one side of it's in Sherman County. We've purchased about 8,000 acres there, are working with BLM to acquire, sort of either through lease or through acquisition, an additional about 8,000 acres, which when we get it put together will be the largest state park in the system, and it's all on the John Day River, both sides of the river. So we're real excited about that. We just let a construction contract here in the next week or so, and hope to cut the ribbon on that park out in that area in September of this year. But there's a lot of other things going on, but I do appreciate your comments, and I understand what you're saying.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions? Senator Bates.
Thank you. I'm going to try to keep my ways and means hat off as much as I can here, and you can correct me when I'm overstepping.
That's
this
okay.
This is a policy
They're
committee.
They're intrinsically linked. So,
I know,
you know.
It's really tough. So when I hear one of the best-funded departments in the state government effort we've been through the last 10 years saying they can't make it, I get a little concerned. I'm going to share his Senator Haas's feelings on this too also, and what I'm going to ask you to come back to us maybe later, talk to me privately about it, because the Ways and Means Committee will be dealing with this. You've got some embedded cost here with PERS and health care costs that need to be addressed probably, and I'm going to guess that's a big driver for you. We're looking at making some significant change in health care costs through, I assume you're with PEB, we're going to look at that very carefully and see if we can drive those costs down for you. There may or may not be a PERS change. And I'm assuming you're doing the things we would expect you to do, higher fees for out-of-state people, deferred maintenance being bid out to private parties to get the best cost down and get the best product you want. And also, one of the festering problems we had for years was the state fair. We dropped it in your lap probably unfairly a few years ago. I mean, it got to the point at the state fair that they've forgotten to make a bond payment. I mean, just forgotten to make a bond payment. And I'd like to know how they're doing now under your administration. Is it's still, I know the state fair is always going to lose money, or likely to, but is that been restricted? Is that was bonds getting paid off? And when the bonds are paid off, will just the maintenance and the ongoing cost, the fare, be less to your apartment? What's the projected change there?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Bates, if you'll recall, I remember you were on our Natural Resources Committee at that time, so we had lots of discussion about this. There are really two elements of the fare on the financial side of our department. One is the bond service that goes with that. Then the bond payment was missed by somebody else. We've been making them on time.
It was not you.
Right.
Clear. You guys didn't believe they'd done it, but it was not you guys, and that's why we gave it to you.
But so in each subsequent biennium, we've had a bond payment of about $4 million a biennium, and those bonds are due to be paid off, I think all of them, in 2018, I think, is when they will be expired. On the sort of the operations side, the expenditures versus revenue that you generate from the fare, the supplement there has been about $3.5 million. So we have been able to reduce that over time because we've made some considerable changes at the fare itself. It's not so much to do with that 50 weeks of the year, because operating the exposition center part of the fairgrounds over there is really a challenge. Problems with the really figuring out what there's a market for there, and there's facilities there which are aging, which aren't included in these numbers, and so they're really not very marketable. So that's really a challenge. If you just look at the cost of operating the fair, we have taken that down to we're estimating that we probably made about $1 million in the fair this year. That's revenues versus expenditures, but that doesn't count for distribution of overhead and maintenance of the rest of the facilities on the ground. So it's a good indicator, if you will, but it doesn't sort of consider the whole picture. We'd like to talk more about the fair as the session goes on. On the personnel side, Senator Bates, I appreciate your comment. The problem is, you know, when we get out there and those two lines get farther apart, we have a gap, more and more of that becomes personnel costs, and that's, you know, and you know that. What we have done in the department is we have made it a conscious decision not to increase our FTE, and we're working real hard every time we have a vacancy to reevaluate, you know, whether we just fill that position or whether it needs to be repurposed or do we need it. And so that's a very conscious management decision that we make, and we've been able to add some new responsibilities and take on new responsibilities by keeping our FTE constant, and that's our goal there. On maintenance, yes, a lot of our maintenance and repair, rehabilitation work is done by contract. Most of it is done by contract, which is good because that puts the money back in the communities. And generally, there are smaller contractors that do our kind of work, so that's even better. So.
Any other questions, Senator?
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Just before we send you off, I wanted to say that I canoed the John Day, lower portion of the John Day River this past summer, and I saw the site and I heard about it. So we're looking forward to seeing that new park, and hopefully you'll invite our committee out when we kick off. Is that in your district, Senator Hansel, or is that?
Senator Ferrioli's.
Right. So it's we're looking forward to that new park. It looks like you will be definitely coming back, gentlemen. Certainly we have some bills that involve your agency, but I think it would be good to come back and maybe do a presentation about some of the parks, as Senator Haas mentioned. And any other questions or comments, Senator?
On second thought, I think it is in my district.
I believe it. Yes, sir.
Right, Senator Hansel. Because I do think it is, actually.
I do, too. I think you're absolutely right. Sorry.
So it's okay. But we'll make sure and try to get out there if we can. Thank you for your presentation and for being on time. We appreciate it, and I'm sure we'll be inviting you back here.
We'll leave you with a more complete copy of the system plan for late night reading.
Thank you. You can get that to Beth, and she'll make sure and get that out to the committee members.
Thank you.
Yeah, okay. Next, we're going to hear from the governor's office and the more from the executive branch as far as the integrated water quality monitoring package. This is something that's been in the works. We've talked about this in the past, so I've asked Richard Whitman, the Natural Resources Policy Director for the governor, to come and kick us off today. Welcome back, Richard.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder. For the record, Richard Whitman, Governor Kitzhaber's Natural Resources Policy Advisor. I have Greg Sieglitz with me from the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. their monitoring specialist, who's going to talk about the real substance here. I'm going to try to very briefly set an overview for this presentation. You're going to also hear from DEQ, the Department of Forestry, and the Department of Agriculture. And there are some handouts for this presentation that are going around right now. One is a budget memorandum that we've prepared for the Ways and Means Committee on the governor's proposed investments in water quality and coordinated enterprise monitoring. And then there's also a piece from the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board that gives a bit of an overview of the types of water quality monitoring that we do and how they fit together. But let me back up and start from the top here. Oregon really has a unique program when it comes to water quality. We rely on our Department of Environmental Quality to set the overall framework and to do permitting for what are called point sources and deal with urban areas. But water quality in terms of much of the landscape, our forested landscape and agricultural landscape, is handled by the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Forestry. In addition to that, we also have the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, which has funding under Measure 76 and through federal sources to work on watershed health issues across the state. And we also have the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, which also receives funding, largely federal funding, to do monitoring of fish population and watershed health across the state as well. So looking horizontally across the state, we have our urban areas, our forested areas, our agricultural areas, and we are working to integrate across the landscape, across all those different types of landform, how we monitor. There's also vertical integration here. We have over half the state is managed by federal agencies, the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management. And obviously at the local level, we have local governments, we have soil and water conservation districts, we have watershed councils, and then last but not least, we have private landowners. So also looking vertically, integrating between all those different entities. The thrust of this effort is to use both across the landscape and then vertically all those resources and as much as possible coordinate the type of monitoring that we're doing. For several different purposes, and Greg Siegowitz is going to talk about that. But the fundamental purpose is in terms of what we call status and trends monitoring. It's the eyes and ears of our natural resources management programs that are focused on waters and water quality. It's how we decide where we prioritize our work and how we prioritize our work. Otherwise, without the monitoring to do that prioritization, we're really pretty much flying blind. We're working on building relationships, but we're not able to really celebrate successes where our programs are working and give people credit where things are getting better. And we're also not able to focus our work where things are not getting better so that we can turn those trends around. So that's the big picture vision here, is to put together a coordinated monitoring effort more than we've done in the past so that we can work both horizontally and vertically to make sure we are making efficient use of limited resources and getting the most bang for the buck in terms of improving water quality and watershed health in Oregon. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Greg Siegowitz to talk a little bit more about the specifics of monitoring.
You're welcome.
Great. Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to present to you today.
Greg, can you just state your name?
I'm sorry. Greg Siegowitz. For the record, I'm the manager of the monitoring and reporting section at the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. So today I want to talk with you some about our accomplishments as an integrated approach to monitoring in the state of Oregon for natural resources, and also to talk some about the vision of enterprise monitoring as we move forward. I also understand that the committee is interested in hearing a little bit more about OEB's effectiveness monitoring, so I'll provide some information about that towards the end of my presentation. So OEB as an agency is in a unique position as both a funder of activities related to watershed restoration as well as monitoring, and also we're charged in statute with being a catalyst and a liaison between the different agency programs with a specific focus on monitoring. And in our statutes, there is reference to, and the major driver for that is the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds. That program is based on a framework and an approach that is, at the core of it, integration of programs across natural resources. Some of the early actions of the Oregon Plan was to develop a monitoring strategy that included a collective vision for what that monitoring would look like and consist of. An important aspect of that monitoring strategy was the inclusion of databases and database information management, a key part of the monitoring approach. So we've accomplished a lot under the Oregon Plan. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and OEB and DEQ in particular have a very strong role in that, and that continues. The Department of Agriculture, Water Resources Department, and Forestry also have significant roles there. When we talk about enterprise monitoring, we talk about capturing some of those lessons learned through that approach and working as a collaborative body on natural resources to develop strong communication and coordination as we move into other areas of focus, particularly water quality and water quantity. The Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds is certainly broad in its nature. A lot of the work to date has been focused on salmon and salmon habitat with also water quality and water quantity in mind. But the enterprise approach we're discussing now would move those forward, but also add more directly a focus to water quality and water quantity, knowing that that's a primary area of interest to Oregonians. One example of a newly developed partnership that represents this enterprise monitoring approach is one that OEB and the Natural Resource Conservation Service, a federal agency, entered into last year in 2012. That partnership blossomed and included the Department of Environmental Quality and now the Department of Agriculture. And the purpose of that partnership is to share information about projects that are funded and actions that are taken around the state of Oregon to improve water quality and water quantity. It allows us access to information that we would not ordinarily have at both the federal and state level. Purposes of the partnership are to evaluate the success or lack of success of those programs and to do joint analysis and share that information with the agencies, but also export that to the public and stakeholders. Some of the benefits of that partnership recently have shown us that in the Wilson River in the North Coast, in Whitechuse Creek in Central Oregon, that we've seen improvements in water quality in both cases. And in the Whitechuse example, we've seen an increase in stream flow as a result of a lot of actions that were taken by local landowners, private citizens, in some cases the Creamery Association in Tillamook was a particularly important player, stormwater conservation districts, watershed councils, and the agencies. The only reason that we were able to do this is the partnership that we developed allowed us to tap into that information that had been in various formats and compile that together to better understand the success of those programs. I will just mention, if you spend any time traveling through Central Oregon, you have over the last several decades, you've seen the results of this work as you leave the town of Sisters, where historically there was very little flow coming down Whitechuse Creek, the stream across as you head to the east, and now it has flow year-round in much more than it did historically. That conservation effectiveness partnership and I'll transition to talking some about OEB's program, is nested with OEB's larger effectiveness monitoring approach. With the casting forward, looking towards a sunset under Measure 66 several years ago, our board set about creating an effectiveness monitoring program to better understand the investments that had been made. Effectiveness monitoring was not something that was built inherently within our grant program initially, and so we had some catch-up to do. But in the time of the last 5 to 6 years, we've invested in monitoring culvert replacements and small dam removal, the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program, riparian restoration more broadly, and livestock exclusion fencing along streams. We've also focused on irrigation efficiency work and western juniper treatment. I mention those because what we've done is tried to align our effectiveness monitoring program with where the large investments in restoration have been. And the results have been a variety, but generally fairly good. And I'll just give you one example. On the South Coast, we looked at all of the culvert and barriers to fish removal that had been taking place over the last 8 to 12 years, and 85% of those barriers now had juvenile salmonids above salmon above them when it was known that they were not there prior to the treatment. So not only were the projects functioning, but 8 and 10, 12 years later, they were still meeting the goals originally intended for them. I guess with that, I'll just wrap up and give you a sense of, as we cast forward under the OEB's long-term investment strategy that we're developing with our board, and thinking of enterprise monitoring, there are several aspects that we hope to focus on and achieve. The enterprise monitoring approach for us is framed around several principles. One is that it would be strategic, meaning we'd focus geographically, focus on different topic areas. We would have an eye towards the outcomes, the governor's 10-year outcomes for the healthy environment, as well as ecological outcomes for individual actions. It would be based on collaboration and partnership across agencies and also with stakeholders. Customer service oriented, meaning the results that we gain from this work would be intended to be shared freely and in a format that's easily accessible and useful for interested parties. And that finally, we would base this on our experiences under the Oregon Plan and other examples like that.
Okay. Any questions so far? All right. You keep on going. I know we have some other folks that are going to come up as well.
So we're going to have Dick Peterson from DEQ come up next, followed by Department of Forestry and Department of Ag to talk about their participation in
this. Actually, why don't we have, just in the essence of time, unless, do you want to stay up here, Richard?
No.
Why don't we have Lisa Hansen from ODA, and we also have Peter Daugherty. Why don't you all come up? Oh, Tom, were you planning to come up?
No.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Dick Peterson, Director of Oregon DEQ. I'm really pleased to be here today and appreciate the summary that was given, the overview by Richard and the summary given by Greg as an indication about how important water quality monitoring is and how important it is to share information and data. Obviously, DEQ does a lot of work in the water quality monitoring arena, so I'm going to highlight some of that work, but I just want to overlay that with the importance of how we do share data, how we do work together, and how important that is to lead to collaboration on getting to looking at opportunities to make improvements in water quality. My belief, and I think it's a belief of many people out there, is that in order to make improvements in water quality, you have to have a good baseline of information and data that informs a decision on where you need to go. And I think that's the premise behind the water quality data and monitoring that we do at DEQ and share with the agencies that are up here today and other agencies. Before I get started, I wanted to, number one, thank you, Chair Dingfelder, and Senator Olson also, that has come out to our Hillsborough lab, our new lab, where we do the analysis for water quality monitoring. We're pretty proud of that facility. It's a great facility, and certainly invite any members of the committee to come out and take a look. It's quite state of the art, and really quite different than where we were in the basement of Portland State University before. So certainly invite any of you to come out and take a look at the lab anytime you'd like.
I was going to say it's a pretty impressive facility, and the fact that it's housed jointly with DHS, so
correct.
It's worth a visit, and it is in Senator Hass's backyard, practically.
Right.
I don't think it's in your district, but pretty darn close. We did used to do field trips. Unfortunately, because of budgets, we are not allowed to anymore, but I would encourage you to go out and have a tour. It's really worth it.
Yeah. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is ambient monitoring that DEQ does. We have somewhere around 130 stations statewide on water bodies that range from across the landscape from urban to rural, bottomlands to uplands. And we've had those stations in place for something like 35 years where we do routine monitoring. And the primary purpose of that is to look at trends in water quality across the state to see how we're doing just generally and look at different landscape types and hopefully use that to inform where we're going to do our work and apply our resources to make gains and really give the state of Oregon and Oregonians a picture of how we're doing in water quality. And I think one of the graphs, I think, on the papers that you have showed that, how we're doing in terms of trends in water quality across the state. And certainly that's very very good information that helps us and others decide how we work forward. Also wanted to say that in the way of partnership, Oregon Department of Agriculture in the last must have been 2 years ago about Lisa provided funding to DEQ to add 19 states in an ambient water quality monitoring way. They're not part of our trend analysis because they're newer stations, but the idea there is to help inform the Department of Agriculture and their stakeholders in terms of looking at where things are working well and where improvements are needed. So that's a great partnership opportunity and where we collect the samples and do the analysis and share that with Oregon Department of Agriculture. Now, shifting from ambient monitoring, just to look at the picture of water quality, is we do a lot of work around our responsibilities under the Clean Water Act. And so a little bit of framework for that is the basis for a lot of what we do in DEQ and other agencies is respond to our responsibilities under the Clean Water Act. The Clean Water Act is a federal act, and we, the state of Oregon, are delegated the responsibility to implement that act. Part of that is to set water quality standards. Standards are set to protect beneficial uses in the state. Quite honestly, salmonids, endangered species, are the major driver for standards and what goes into those. So our commission, Environmental Quality Commission, does pass rule that sets the standard. That's submitted to the Environmental Protection Agency. If there's endangered species involved, then that's consulted with the fish agencies, NOAA Fishery, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and EPA would eventually approve our standards. Once a standard is improved, we do, through our own data collection and other data that's submitted to us, look at whether water bodies are or are not meeting water quality standards. So that's kind of a data-rich monitoring effort where we look at, see where water bodies are doing well or not against water quality standards. If a water body is not meeting water quality standards, then we're obligated under the Clean Water Act to list those as across the state, those bodies that aren't meeting water quality standards. And then we're obligated to put out what's called a total maximum daily load. The layman's version of that, from my view, is what's the plan, if you will, for bringing that water body back into compliance with water quality standards. And again, that's driven by a federal requirement that we do those TMDLs, total maximum daily loads. So we approach it in Oregon in DEQ from not just a little tiny segment of water. We look at an entire watershed and basin, whether it be the Umatilla or the Tualatin or the Willamette. Just take a broad look at basins in terms of water quality, and how do we approach that whole watershed in a way to not only understand it, but help drive improvements that might need to be made. So the first thing that we do is we go into that basin and do a rich set of monitoring. We collect data and information to, one, verify whether or not that water body is in fact out of compliance and get a better understanding of where specifically problems might occur. And then from that information and data, the end product is, so what basically needs to be done to bring that water body back into compliance. So how we do that is we go into a basin not in isolation with DEQ, but work with in collaboration with a lot of partners. Watershed counselors are there, our sister state agencies, their stakeholders to help with understanding this data and use it for looking at what might be called pollution reduction plans. So it's a monitoring-rich program. We do a lot of not only data collection, but do a lot of analysis of that data, modeling of that data. So the foundation, though, is a really good, important set of data that is being collected. We're trying something a little bit newer in the state now, and it's called an implementation-ready TMDL, and that's being done on the Midcoast. And my view of that is historically what we've done is a fairly linear process where DEQ goes in and we get data from others, we work it up, pull it together, and say, okay, here's what it's telling us, hand it off to stakeholders and say, okay, what do we need to do to get this done? Rather, what we're trying to do under this pilot is work all together in the front, you know, collect data together up front, analyze it up front together, really come to that conclusion of what needs to be done together, and that becomes the whole package of what's called an implementation-ready TMDL. Now, again, it's data-rich and monitoring-rich. So then the last thing I was going to mention is just groundwater. Groundwater is a very important resource in Oregon, and the governor's budget is providing us proposed budget is providing us with some resources to do some more groundwater monitoring to help inform citizens in areas where groundwater might be impacting their drinking water. A lot of people in the state use wells for their drinking water. So that was my overview. We do a lot more in the way of monitoring, but that's sort of the bigger picture side of it. And certainly, again, where I started, certainly happy to have you come out the lab and talk more about DEQ's monitoring program.
Great. Thank you, Dick. Before we hand it off to, I don't know who wants to go next. Is Lisa going next? Peter? Just a quick question about the groundwater monitoring. So I'm assuming this is for water quality purposes, and we've had major cuts to our groundwater monitoring for water quantity programs and for water quality. So are you looking at any type of collaboration with WRD? Because we're leaving money on the table with USGS because we can't find matching funds for federal dollars. And so is there any way, I realize obviously water quality monitoring is not the same type of test in wells for quantity, but is there any way to collaborate with WRD on that?
Yeah, Chair Dingfelder, thanks for that question. And I know Water Resources is going to come up and talk about the integrated water strategy, but I think the framework for all of this stuff is the step to move towards integrating and collaborating. So I would say right now that they're operating a little bit on separate parallel paths in terms of water quantity and water quality, but staff and others are talking, but those paths are starting to converge, and I see the integrated water strategy as making that happen. So I think not in the too distant future, you'll see a lot more of that integrated sharing across different kinds of monitoring, quantity and quality.
And then last question about federal budget cuts, because we have been receiving funding for the Safe Drinking Water Act. How is that going to affect monitoring for groundwater supplies if we see future cuts?
Chair Dingfelder, I can't speak for the public health side because public health does drinking water and get those funds. So on our side, we get some resources for safe drinking water protection programs. Those are remaining fairly flat. Our agency in particular doesn't get groundwater monitoring money from the federal government just generally, but that comes through the Safe Drinking Water Act. Yeah.
Peter.
Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee, For the record, Peter Doherty. I'm the Department of Forestry's Private Forest Division Chief, and I'm here to discuss forestry's role in supporting water quality and integrated monitoring. As Richard mentioned, Oregon statutes creates a cooperative relationship between the Board of Forestry and the Environmental Quality Commission to ensure water quality protection on forest lands. Excuse me. The Commission sets water quality standards, as Dick mentioned, and the Board establishes rules to ensure that forest practices meet those standards. This relationship has resulted in a long-term collaboration between DEQ and the Department of Forestry in evaluating the effectiveness of Oregon's forest practice rules. This collaboration is supported by scientific research, coordinated monitoring, and shared data that informs adaptive management. For example, forestry uses the DEQ ambient monitoring results as one of our key performance measures, and our board has adopted those measures as one of the indicators of sustainable forestry. An example of our coordinated adaptive management is our ongoing riparian function and stream temperature monitoring project. Designed and conducted in cooperation with DEQ and stakeholders, this study measures the effectiveness of stream protection rules on both state and private forest land. Project results have led to the board's current rule analysis process to improve forest practice rules on small and medium fish streams. The governor's proposed investment supports this ongoing coordinated monitoring and provides some key enhancements to our integrated approach. The investment provides support for our participation in Oregon's State University's Watershed Research Cooperative, specifically the Trask River Watershed Study. This paired watershed study is a federal, state, and private integrated monitoring effort that examines the effectiveness of strategies to maintain and protect headwater streams. This study will provide key monitoring information and data to support the TMDL process that Dick mentioned by evaluating how small streams respond to forest harvest and if those responses carry downstream. Finally, the investment adds some capacity to sustain and improve interagency coordinated monitoring efforts and to move beyond traditional regulatory approaches. For us, it will increase our capacity to continue coordination, participate in the pesticide stewardship partnerships, and continue to support coordinated monitoring such as rip stream and paired watershed studies. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. Lisa, well done.
For the record, Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm delighted to have the opportunity to visit with you once again about the Agricultural Water Quality Program. It seems like we have been before you several times during the interim, talking about where the program's been and our vision for the future of this program. And so just by way of background for some of the new members, Mr. Whitman talked briefly about integration and collaboration, and that really is the backbone of the Agricultural Water Quality Program. We rely heavily on our local partners in the Soil and Water Conservation Districts, our state agency partners for data and financial assistance, and our federal partners to provide financial assistance and technical assistance to farmers on the ground. To date, the program has been implemented in really an opportunistic way. Projects have been implemented where there was opportunity and interest with landowners. As a result of that, one of the challenges we have is to be able to answer the tough questions that are coming at us. Is the program working? Is agriculture doing its part? Or agriculture may say to us, can you tell our story better than you are telling it today? And the key issue there is data. We haven't done a great job of accounting for the work that's been done on the ground, doing it in some connective way to look at it on a watershed basis and going in and making changes where we could look at outcomes over time. So the monitoring package is incredibly important to our program and its future to help us align our work strategically on a watershed basis, to do an initial assessment of what's going on within a watershed, to account for the work that's done, and then to measure the outcomes over time.
That's it. So a couple of quick questions for you, Lisa. Last time you were in front of the committee, we had an update on the Clean Water Act, and you talked about the different strategies that you were looking at for assessing effectiveness for Senate Bill 1010. So can you provide an update on some of those specifics? Because I know you were making recommendations with the Board of Ag, and can you provide us with an update on status?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd be happy to talk with you a little bit about status. So over the past year and a half or so, we've really been looking at the Ag Water Quality Program and how to show if it's being effective and to look at maturing the program. Historically, the program has been a complaint-based program, and so the ongoing conversations have been, do we need to move to something else? Board of Agriculture has been very engaged in these conversations, and we will be meeting with them at the end of the month and looking at having a conversation about really opening up the toolkit within the Department of Agriculture, continuing with a complaint-based program, adding additional observations by department staff to initiate site visits and do work, and then finally really aligning work for strategic implementation of the ag water quality plans on the ground. And when I talk about strategic implementation, we're proposing the idea of taking a couple of areas, potentially pilots on the east side and the west side, working with our partners at the local, state, and national level to align the resources to go in and do the work that I talked about, be able to account for that, and then move it, monitor it to see the ongoing effectiveness.
Okay. And if you could provide to the committee the information that you're going to provide to the Board of Ag in preparation for that, I think that would be helpful.
We'll be happy to do so.
Okay, great. Any other questions for the panel? Welcome, Vice Chair. Okay. All right. Well, I'm sure we'll be hearing more about this. And for I guess I'm the only one here sitting on the budget committee, so I know I'll be hearing a lot more. Thank you. Before we move on to our last item, the Integrated Water Resources Strategy, I wanted to welcome my Vice Chair, Senator Olson. Welcome back, and really pleased to have you back here. We already went around and did introductions. Told their most embarrassing moment, so
oh, good.
You can. But if you could just provide an introduction, what your district is, and a little bit of background about you, and welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a pleasure to be the Vice Chair of Natural Resources again. I was a little late. I've got a really good recipe for chocolate chip cookies, and I couldn't get here in time to. As people ask me for it. I am a general contractor. I live in Canby. My district is Senate District 20, and with redistricting, I picked up an enormous amount of agricultural land. My district actually doubled in geographic size, and it's all right down the heart of Clackamas County. So it's a pleasure to be on Natural Resources, to be able to represent my good colleagues and folks in Clackamas County. As I said, I am a general contractor. This is a great job. I've been on it for 2 years, and I'm really looking forward to the next two. And thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to be your Vice Chair.
Great. Thank you. And we are just about to hear our last presentation for the day. And a reminder that we're going to be in the future back in Hearing Room C. This is just a special detail because they needed to find a place for us today. So with that, I would like to invite up the Water Resources Department. We have the Director, Phil Ward, and the Senior Policy Coordinator, Brenda Bateman. For some of us, we've heard this before, and it looks like we've Richard Whitman back. But for our new members, I wanted to make sure we had an overview of the Integrated Water Resources Strategy, because we'll be hearing quite a bit more about that this session. Some of the bills tie in to the strategy. So. Pleased to have you here, and I see you have a whole new slides. They're very fancy. Okay. With that, whoever wants to kick it off.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, Richard Whitman, Governor Kitzhaber's Natural Resource Advisor, back up here before you. I'm going to do just a very brief intro for this item also. As the chair knows, we just did a presentation on this in the Ways and Means sub. And so part of the reason I'm back up here is just to talk about this from the budget aspect. This is the major area of investment in the governor's recommended budget in the natural resource program area is on implementation of the integrated water resources strategy. So I want to just frame that a little bit, and then I'll turn it over to Phil Ward, the director of the Water Resources Department, and Brenda Bateman, who really did the hard on-the-ground work in terms of pulling this strategy together over the course of the last year to talk to you about the strategy particularly. But to go back up to a higher level, this is an area of emphasis for proposed investment in the governor's recommended budget. And there are several aspects of that. First of all, there is ongoing work to implement authorization and funding that the legislature previously approved in terms of the Umatilla project. This is an effort out in Umatilla and Morrow counties to do aquifer storage and recharge. And that pilot program has been begun, making good progress. More recently, there's interest in the basin in expanding that effort, and in the spring of last year, 2012, Governor Kitzhaber convened an Oregon Solutions Project for that area, known as the Columbia-Umatilla-Oregon Solutions Team. That effort was really to develop a list, to achieve consensus on a list of specific projects that a broad range of interest in that part of the state could come to agreement on that warrant moving forward on in the short term for a variety of purposes. First and foremost, in terms of an opportunity in terms of job creation, economic development in that part of the state. This is very high value, value-added agriculture in that area. But we've also made great strides in terms of conservation in that area, particularly the Umatilla tribes working together with others have restored the fishery in the Umatilla River. And there are other opportunities like that in that part of the state to have conservation benefits as well as benefits in terms of economic development. So next week, that Oregon Solutions team will meet in Portland to sign a declaration of cooperation where they have agreed on a short list of projects, and the governor's budget does include funding in it for at least the initial work to implement those projects. So we're very pleased about that and really see that effort as a pilot for what we would like to see elsewhere in the state in terms of moving Oregon into a more active role in water resources development. So going from that to the statewide lens, we also have been working at the statewide level to address some issues, really fundamental policy issues about when is it appropriate for the state to help finance some of these efforts. Some of our neighboring states, Washington and California, have been much more active than Oregon in this area, and we're playing catch up to some degree, but there is significant interest around the state in really leaning into this and developing an active program in Oregon. Some of the groundwork for that was done in 2009 with House Bill 3369, which set up criteria for funding of water resources project. The chair was involved in that effort and remembers it well, I'm sure. There's a desire on on the part of a wide range of interest to really make sure that we have a legislative frame for a program that is workable and that works for conservation interest as well as out-of-stream interest. So we've had an informal work group working on that for several months now. They are making good progress. They're not quite there yet, but we are optimistic and that we will have legislation to bring before you all, likely to this committee later in this session, dealing with some of those issues in terms of criteria for funding. Lastly, I just want to touch on the investment package that is in the governor's budget. So we have initial staffing at the Water Resources Department, Department of Agriculture, and Department of Fish and Wildlife to work on this effort. There also is proposed funding for a separate fund for feasibility studies for projects that is an existing program that's been very popular in the state. And then capitalization of both loan and grant funds, both for the Umatilla area work, but also for to start some work elsewhere in the state as well. Finally, I just want to stress that the funding here, the concept behind this is both for water storage projects that involve above ground and below ground storage, but also funding for other types of efforts to develop water resources for multiple use. So there's funding for improved work on efficiency, water conservation measures, improvement of habitat, in-stream water rights, really the whole package of tools that we need to bring to bear to address these issues. I mentioned our neighboring states. I just want to briefly note the real driver for this is both a concern in terms of economic development, but also what we're seeing in terms of long-term trends in water resources in the state. We are seeing that most of our streams, most of our groundwater is fully appropriated or fast approaching that. We're seeing temperatures change such that we no longer have the natural storage and snowpack in the Cascades and other mountain ranges that we historically have had. So there's a real need because of population growth, our desire for continued economic growth, and what's changing in our environment that we really start to become much more active in this area. And that's why you see this as being the area of major investment in the governor's recommended budget for this part of state government. So look forward to working with you as well as Ways and Means on pulling that package together as we go forward. And with that, I'll turn it over to Phil Ward and Brenda Bateman.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Phil Ward with the Water Resources Department. And thank you, members, for being with us at 4:30 on this afternoon. So we'll try and go through a few slides quickly for you and then be happy to respond to any questions. And I'm going to do the first set, and Brenda's going to cover the last bit. So you'll recall that you all gave us, a number of you all gave us the charge in 2009 to develop a strategy. I have my personal copy with me of Oregon's first integrated water resources strategy, which was adopted by the Water Resources Commission this last August. This strategy asked the Water Resources Department to lead this effort and to look at both in-stream and out-of-stream water resource needs in this state. Specifically charged us to partner with DEQ, ODFW, ODA, and other natural resource agencies, both at the state and federal level, but also the tribes, stakeholders. So we had quite a group of folks involved in this program. And we were to account for coming pressures in this document like climate change. So it's interesting, but Oregon yields about 96 million acre-feet of water per year. And of that water resource, there's only about 8% of it that's actually diverted. Add to that that we protect nearly twice that for in-stream use in this state, actually more than the states of Washington, Montana, and Idaho combined by a magnitude of 3, do we protect in stream, formerly for fish in this state, and water quality. But the majority of the pie is unallocated, and if that's the case, what's the problem? Well, there are a number of reasons that our water resource is limited in this state, and I'm just going to touch on those real quickly here. You all know that our state is a tale of two states in terms of precipitation. The east side of our state, precipitation, Senator, is limited. I think you would agree. But even on the west side, we have challenges in the summer months in terms of our water resource. The issue is a matter of timing as well. There's an inverse relationship between when water is available here in Oregon through stream flow and when crops need it. This is not the Midwest. As you all know, there isn't significant growing season precipitation available for agriculture, and so agriculture, one of our largest customers at the department, definitely has summer water needs. Another interesting piece of the equation here, and perhaps one of the most troubling pieces of the equation, is the potential in terms of what happens in the years ahead in terms of how we receive our water resource. Right now, in the slide on the left, you see where precipitation falls primarily as snow in the state. If some of the projections for climate change come true, and a 3-degree temperature increase over the next 50 years would change dramatically how precipitation falls in our state. So you see us moving from a snow-based precipitation regime to a rain-based precipitation regime. The result is we lose that great natural storage for water that our state has relied on throughout its history. Water quality has been a key piece, as you've heard earlier, and DEQ was a key partner in this effort of the Integrated Water Resources Strategy, and there are significant water quality needs in our state. Certainly, groundwater, both quality and quantity, there are dramatic needs in our relative to our groundwater resource in both these areas. And you can see a joint map here with DEQ and WRD groundwater management areas identified. But perhaps the most famous groundwater challenges in our state are in Senator Hansel's district, where we have seen groundwater declines in some irrigation wells of up to 500 feet. And the sad reality then is that that has forced our agency to restrict groundwater use in those areas up to around 12-15% of what their water right permits would otherwise allow. And that relates directly to the efforts that Richard described earlier relative to the Governor's Community Solutions Group. There are certainly challenges relative to our water resources in terms of fish and fish passage. And again, ODF&W and ODA were key partners in this integrated water resource strategy effort.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me this afternoon. Brenda Bateman with the Water Resources Department. I served as the project manager for the Integrated Water Resources Strategy. And from the very beginning, both the legislature and the Water Resources Commission gave us some very specific marching orders. One was to make sure that we were building upon a good foundation of policy and data. Oregon is known as a leader in many of these areas. We have a good foundation in place, even if we haven't made recent investments in these areas. And so they wanted to make sure we took account of that. Secondly, very important, and we heard a lot from the public about this, that we were, as part of this process, to preserve the rights and authorities that are in place today. This is a planning exercise to anticipate and prepare for things that might be coming, not to throw away the assets, the water rights, and the things that we already have put in place today. So that was a very important premise for this project. Also, there's a lot of room for improvement through partnership, through voluntary and incentive-based approaches. And so that is the tack that we took putting this strategy together and putting recommendations together. Our commission in particular was very clear that the recommendations were to be practical and implementable, not a plan that would sit on a shelf and collect dust, but something that we could go to work on immediately. And that's what you'll see in the next few slides. With that in mind, some of the implementation requires, yes, some legislative action, and so we'll be bringing some proposals to you over the next several months, but some also requires no legislative action, and we've already begun good work and begun and completed some work on improving our informational materials, making our web pages more clear and usable to the public, and engaging in some areas that don't require either policy or budget discussion. And finally, there was a heavy focus in this project on getting the data that was required for decision making, and that's really where I wanted to focus next. There are three primary themes that were coming out of this strategy that you're likely to see and hear about over the next several weeks and months. Number one is data. Our policy advisory group, which was 18 citizen members from across the state, unanimously agreed on this, no matter what other perspectives they had. Data was the number one recommendation coming out of the strategy. We don't have adequate water quantity or water quality data, surface water or groundwater data, to be making some of the decisions we need to move forward in the future. And I would say the group focused particularly heavily on groundwater data, knowing that the county planners were asking us.
Before you leave that slide, if I could, I just would note that the stream gauge on the right is not a typical Oregon Water Resources Department stream gauge. Most of them look a little bit like a Forest Service outhouse, usually. This is a stream gauge that is compliant with community covenants. This is actually a Forest Service stream gauge on the Metolius River, and they had certain standards they wanted us to abide by when we put it in.
First theme is data. The second theme, and Richard Whitman already talked about this a few moments ago, is the development of a more coherent, more thorough water supply development program for the state. We look sometimes to our neighboring states and see how much investment they've made and how they've really put a framework together for water supply development, and we're a few steps behind here in Oregon. So you'll see some packages coming forward that both provide for more robust authorities as well as funding and investment for a water supply development program moving forward. And the third theme that we wanted to point out to you this afternoon was this idea of ensuring a system, a better system of folks on the ground who are trained and experienced both in our field program as well as in our scientific program to protect both stream flow and supply water for economic development. Interestingly, the Water Resources Department has a dual mission, and it's both to protect stream flow and to supply water for economic development. We identified many opportunities as part of this strategy discussion to make forward movement in both areas. So we're very excited about that. One of the dangers, though, that we always have in the back of our mind that worries us a bit is that we have no federal backup at the Water Resources Department. Our job is to manage the water, to allocate and distribute the water to senior water right holders. And unlike some of our sibling agencies, we don't have a federal counterpart that we can lean on. And so we're always on the front lines with that work.
I have a quick question about that. In the latest WERDA package for the federal level, is there any Oregon projects, do you know, being requested?
Madam Chair, there may well be. I haven't seen the latest workup on it. There have been standing proposals relative to the Walla Walla, I know in particular, that got caught in the no earmarks regulations recently adopted federally. So I'm not certain what's there for, if there's anything specific for Oregon right now.
Over the next several weeks and months, members will be seeing and hearing about both budget and policy proposals that have come from the strategy, and those were our marching orders originally from the legislature. Come back to us with a series of recommendations that we can act upon. I think Richard Whitman has gone down through that handout with you and hit many of these items so far. So what I wanted to do was jump to a conclusion here and point out that we are working on a number of levels with many of our state, federal, and local agency partners, both to take legislative action, to request legislative action, and also to move forward on some independent projects. The work plan that goes with the strategy is multi-year and staged. We recognize that the recommendations that are in the strategy, and they fall in 13 different issue areas, are overwhelming and too much to tackle all at once. We have a work plan that goes along with this document that shows which pieces we need to act on first before we can get to some of the latter pieces. And so I wanted you to know that we are very sensitive to and have realized this needs to be a staged and phased exercise. And with that, we also recognize that the next version of the strategy is due to the legislature in now just 4 short years. And so we're always having that in the top of our minds. And should you be interested, all of these documents and materials throughout the whole development of the program are available on site, online. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for panel members?
Mr. Whitman, thank you for being here. As you know, 2 years ago, we had a bill that would have taken Columbia River water and replenished the Umatilla Aquifer, and the governor was a little bit cold to it. What has transpired that he's kind of been more selective and interested in this project, in the fact that that bill would have created 16,000 jobs and irrigated 80,000 acres of water? Why now has he looked at it?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, the issue with the legislation that was proposed in the 2011 session is it reflected some policy direction that did not have broad consensus in the basin, and the reason for that was that it was looking at diverting water, live flow, out of the Columbia River during the period of the year, during the summer, when federal agencies have determined that the Columbia River does not have sufficient water required for fisheries. So you can agree or disagree with where the federal agencies are on that, but the reality is there have been repeated efforts to run up that hill over the years that have failed. What is different about this is that the governor worked very closely with local interests, and I want to single out Commissioner Doherty in particular, who's the co-convener for this effort, who's just done a masterful job in bringing together all the diverse interests in that area. And we have something that everybody is behind and something that it can be accomplished in the short term that we have consensus about. So that's really the difference. The governor has always been supportive of water resources development in this area and other areas of the state, as long as it can be done in compliance with existing laws and ideally through this sort of collaborative effort. So we believe this is an important step forward, one that is supported across the basin in that part of the state, and that we want to replicate elsewhere in the state as well.
And I just want to note that we have, I think the end of this month, we have an update on the Umatilla project, so we're going to have a presentation here. Senator Hansel.
Chair Dingfelder, in answer to Senator Olson's question too, one of the things they did in the basin that's different now than then, they kicked out one of their commissioners, county commissioners, sent him to Salem. So that was a big.
Well, it's their loss and our gain. So there you go. It is in your basin, and certainly we're looking forward to having the presentation here in a few weeks. So
great,
appreciate that. Any other questions? Thank you very much,
thank you.
Gentlemen, thank you. Ladies, and thank you. With that, committee members, we're done for the evening. I want to just remind you, on Monday, we will be in Hearing Room C, where you have three bills up, one Park Service and or from Parks, and two from the Water Resources Department.
Water Resources.
With that, we are adjourned.
Thank you.